Welcome to everyone. Our speakers tonight are Dr. Ken Mathis and Dr. Phil Noble. These are names that you all know. Dr. Mathis, the chair of our Department of Orthopedics, came here from Baylor College of Medicine, well-respected, well-known adult reconstructive and joint surgeon. And Dr. Noble, also a very well-recognized name around the world, designer of implants, student of biomechanics, and very accomplished investigator in the field. And we're looking forward to hearing what they have to say about the present and the future. Dr. Mathis will start.
Thank you, Dirk. I'd like to thank everybody for coming here. We're going to talk today about new horizons in orthopedic research, quantification of surgical technique. Most of you know orthopedic surgeons are different. Dirk reminds me of that constantly. But even the type of research that we do is different, and you're going to see things that aren't typical to the other grand rounds here. We think about things in a different way, and there's more of a practical application of making procedures better or improving the outcomes. What is orthopedics? How many people here actually know what that word means? Just a show of hands. It's interesting. It comes from the root Greek orthos, meaning to straighten or erect. You think of orthostatic hypotension. And pedics comes from Greek, also pedics, meaning children. So this specialty was actually evolved in the treatment of polio, and it means to straighten children. And this is relevant. I wanted people to get an understanding of where the specialties come from. As surgeons that became very adept at musculoskeletal disorders evolved into treating adult disorders of the musculoskeletal system, we saw something happen in orthopedics that changed the face of it. In the 50s, we got the vaccine for polio. And my mentors here, George Lane and Dick Epright, told me that in the 60s, they were doing 25 to 27 polio surgeries a week here at Methodist, and then it went away. But something else happened in orthopedics at that same time. A brilliant man in England named Sir John Charnley, he was knighted for his work that he did, brought to the world one of the biggest advances in orthopedics, joint replacement. And this was, by all accounts, a genius that took things and materials that we had available but hadn't been used in orthopedics to construct a hip, come up with a methyl methacrylate, a bone cement that would anchor it, and come up with the plastic, the polyethylene. And how he even came up with the polyethylene is interesting. He tried nylon. He tried Teflon. He was trying different things that would initially work but would fail spectacularly within a few months. And a salesman that sold sewer pipes that were resistant to urine and feces were made of this new material called polyethylene. And a sewer pipe salesman called on him and said, I want you to take a look at this. And his head of research actually did. And that launched the total joint revolution that we have today. Well, that's relevant because in the 60s, then, this procedure has taken off. And this is projections from this month's Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery looking at total knee arthroplasty, the projections for where we're going to see by 2030 and for total hip arthroplasty. And in revisions, we see this exponential curve going up as well as our population ages and the demographics indicate how many we're going to do. So by 2030, we're going to see total hip replacements increase to 174% of the volume we're doing now. Total knee replacements are going to increase 673% to 3.5 million procedures a year. Revision total hips will double by 2026, and revision total knees in a very short period of time by 2015. And the implications are we need to start making these implants better. So what we started with, and we have to look at what this Charnley hip did for us, which was truly remarkable, we had great results, probability of survival early on. But if you look at young patients, you can see a steep curve out to 20 years where it's roughly 50% survival of just having the implant in place. So that's where we started. And the rest of the talk today is how we're going to make this better. So what are the advances that we've seen? Number one, just fixation. How do you fix this implant to the bone? Initially, you see on the left a cement. Then you see voids or cracks in the cement where this implant and around the polyethylene, this white material, is a cement. Well, we actually came up with in orthopedics an improvement on cementing implants, and we call it biologic fixation or bone ingrowth. And you can see if you make a roughened titanium or metal substrate, you can actually get this pink material, which is the bone, to literally grow into and grab onto implants. Down in the bottom left, this is a slide from Germany Dr. Wagner sent me, where you can see actually cortical bone growing into the medullary canal to get onto the titanium. This isn't just tolerated by the body. The bone is actually growing aggressively onto the implants. And on the right here, Dr. Kevin Lester gave me this slide of a 94-year-old woman with a 5-year implantation. And you can see an osteoporotic bone literally osseous integration, anchoring this prosthesis. The significance of this can be a lifetime bond. This isn't a cement that can crack or become brittle. So if we get a biologic fixation, this may last the length of time that the patient needs it. Well, what next was a problem? Next, it was wear. It wasn't just fixing the implant. What's rubbing on what and what's causing wear? And it's interesting, putting in the polyethylene plastic, we invented, and cement, we invented a new disease that didn't exist. It's called osteolysis. This is an orthopedic disease that was created by particles. And you can see the massive erosion of the femur here based on the polyethylene particles and some of the particles from generated from the coating around this implant. So these small particles, roughly 1 micron in size, the size of a bacteria, the body recognizes as a foreign invader and engulfs them with foreign body giant cells and macrophages, which release inflammatory mediators, which activate osteoclasts and cause this massive erosion. This is why we follow people up, even if they're not hurting, every year or two to check, because this can be a silent disease, and we don't want to see it get to this. This is the same patient with a modern implant with a rough surface that bone grows into and a biologic fixation, and you can see reconstitution of the femur, and she's now almost 10 years out from this implant that we implanted here at Methodist. So we've got biologic fixation, but how have we improved the wear? By the bearing materials. If you look here on the left, the metal polyethylene bearing, this is the wear rate in millimeters, cubic millimeters per year. And if you look at ceramic on the polyethylene or the plastic, metal bearings, and ceramic bearings, you've seen a dramatic decrease in the volume of the particles being released. And this is what is going to lead to reduction in the osteolysis. So now we have a biologic fixation that may last the length of lifetime of the patient and a bearing surface that may do the same. And you can see here in microns or wear per year, a ceramic bearing, a cobalt chrome on cobalt chrome or metal bearing, gamma sterilized in air polyethylene, which was our standard from the 60s, and then with cross-linked or improved polyethylenes. There's one cross-linked polyethylene that's been tested to 27 years of walking in a gait laboratory at Harvard, and you could still see the machine marks on the retrieval of the implant, and those are 10 microns high. So we now have the potential for fixation and a bearing surface that will outlast our patients, and we're going to see, as a consequence, these joints being put in younger and younger patients. So we may have made big strides on the first two. But what's next? Where did our attention turn? And it was to make the procedure less invasive. And so we started a lot of work here, the lab, and many of the engineers are here with us, and Dr. Noble and myself, looking at ways to make the procedure less invasive. And we began to see a patient that we call the millennium patient. These are young patients, 40 to 60, demanding, very aggressive, internet savvy. They think high tech is better. Cost is a secondary concern to them getting treatment. And the surgery is a lifestyle expense, so they can continue to do the high impact or high demand things they want to do. They were looking for improvements in the quality of life, not the longevity or how long this device would last, and they were willing to travel if necessary. And so we saw thousands of patients going to Europe and to India to get technologies that weren't yet available in the U.S. Some of those were things such as cartilage transplantation. Hip resurfacing had been in the rest of the world for many years, and we just got this device approved last year in the U.S., a resurfacing hip. Hip arthroscopy, unispacer, or little spacers to try to buy more time in knees, unicondylar or partial knee replacements, and minimally invasive joint surgery. So part of our minimally invasive research and development program was to set five things that we hope to accomplish here. One of them was computer simulation of the minimally invasive surgery and total hip replacement. Rather than doing this on patients directly, we wanted to take a very rational approach to perfect this and have computer simulation help us get to the answers. We wanted a computerized bioskills module, and Dr. Noble's going to talk extensively about computerized bioskills. We wanted enhanced minimally invasive instruments, and I'll show you why you needed special instruments to do this surgery. The implants needed to change to facilitate putting them in through smaller incisions and less invasive approaches. And then we wanted to use a computer to see if we could optimize the approach to putting these implants in. So number one was just computer simulation of the surgery. Well, why would we need to do that? Well, if we could accomplish that, we could measure soft tissue deformation. We could visualize what we're attempting to achieve. We could compare different approaches and instruments in quantitative terms and then develop a systematic approach for modifying and improving the procedure. And then we thought that this would be a better way to teach or flatten out the learning curve to minimally invasive surgery. But there's some challenges. The quality of the images, getting the soft tissues and the hard tissues into a computer simulation, capturing the information, describing the surgical wound, modeling the deformation, the speed of the data processing, and then the accuracy of simulations. So our work had started here, and this is a CT scan image and reconstruction, looking at a standard hip replacement incision, which 15 to 20 centimeters was considered pretty standard up till recently. And we began to wonder if you could eliminate most of the incision and really concentrate on perhaps a smaller portion in the middle of that. So we began to get cadaveric specimens and try to develop a virtual reality simulation of this procedure. So we looked at initial incisions and then looked at how much could you deform or retract the incision in certain directions. And that was what was fascinating. If you make an incision, it's mobile, but more in some directions than others. So where you place the incision became very key to being able to do things you wanted to do. It also was apparent that making the incision smaller really necessitated getting it in the right place. So a lot of time was spent looking for landmarks to help surgeons understand where on the femur, on the body, you needed to make the incisions and how big for the size of the patient to be able to make a small incision. The next thing was the instruments that we had traditionally been using needed to go in at certain angles to get the implants in the right position and to machine the bone for the artificial implants in the right way. But you would see the skin, compressing the skin here was preventing correct alignment. This is the acetabulum and this is a reamer, would prevent correct alignment to get it in the right orientation. So we had to optimize instruments as well as the approach. So then simulating the operative procedure, you could start to begin to visualize the soft tissues and a zone of access that you were going to be able to use to get to where you needed to be, and could you fit implants into this zone and get them into the femur. So the next challenge was capturing information just describing the wound. Once we knew the right place and the size, where we could put this, what could we describe about the wound and how much damage were we causing? And what really prompted my interest in this was we, with a dedicated team in the old diagnostic ORs, had been able to get hip replacement surgery down to 5 centimeters or 2-inch incisions. And patients loved it. We thought we were doing well, but there was a little bit of you'd see a little maceration at the edges of the incision. This is 6 weeks. We thought things were fine. But this patient came to me at 1 year and said she needed her other hip done. And she said, "Dr. Mathis, I want you to do liposuction on my other hip like you did on this one." And I said, "Ma'am, I didn't take out any fat." "Oh, yes, you did. It looks better than my other side." I said, let me take a look. And I'd never looked at incisions a year later, only at 6 weeks, to see if they were healed. And when I saw this, I knew we had a problem with minimally invasive surgery where we had it. So we could get the parts in through small incisions, but at a cost of possibly causing less cosmesis and increasing complications. The only way you get this sort of appearance is we had to exceed the ability of the tissue to withstand that pressure. This is atrophy or necrosis of the tissue under the skin causing that. So the engineers in the lab, and some of them are here today, and Matt Thompson did quite a bit of work with tattooing grids on cadavers and then letting us use the computer to look at the tension that we were putting on the skin edges. And so they would map with ultraviolet light the skin deformation, and Dr. Noble's going to talk a little bit more about the strains that they could calculate, and develop a finite element model of skin and subcutaneous tissue so that you could then predict on the skin with certain approaches and where retractors were, where you might exceed the pressures that the skin and soft tissues could tolerate. We also had pressure transducers. You can see these green transducers next to the instruments and the retractors during key steps of the procedure to measure the forces, and then we could then see where the main problems were that were putting too much pressure on the skin and start to modify the approach and the instruments to minimize these pressures. Some of the pressures were three times what we would experience with any other retractors in standard orthopedic hip replacement. Well, what's next if it's not the skin and the soft tissues? Taking less bone. And that intuitively sounds better to people. What if you took less bone? I don't like you cutting off the entire femoral head. And this is that resurfacing procedure that we're talking about, and this is an evolution of what we're going to see to come, is less bone resection and devices such as this with a metal-on-metal articulation. Well, why would we even think this is a good idea? Why resurfacing? Well, one of the reasons is this is a survival plot, this bottom curve, much like you saw earlier, only this is Swedish Hip Register in 2000 looking at 10-year survival in young patients, and you can still see, as we go out to 10 years, we're still failing quite a bit in our young patients. But if you look at the Birmingham hip resurfacing, the line at the top, we have small numbers, relatively small numbers, but you're not seeing that decline in young patients. So this may actually be a procedure that really will allow younger patients to become very active. The device is touted and has been placed in professional athletes, ballerinas, marathon runners, and we're still not seeing dramatic failures. So this may hold great, great promise in hips, and you can see the difference between a standard total hip and a resurfacing on your left. Well, what's next? We've talked about fixation lysis, less invasive. What about function? Can we make these, are we doing well with function? Can we make them any better? The NIH has a consensus conference on total knee replacement and had it in 2003. And they had a statement in there that there appears to be rapid and substantial improvement in the patient's pain, functional status, and overall health-related quality of life in about 90% of patients, and 85% of patients are satisfied with the results of surgery. Well, that sounds like a pretty good operation. But should we be satisfied? Is that good enough? And some people might believe that 90% doing well means they don't have any problems with function. And we have some objective evidence that this may not be true. And if 85% are satisfied, what about the other 15%? So clearly there's improvement. And two of the biggest areas of improvement that we can look at are, number one, technique. Technique is a key to having consistency of outcome. And Dr. Noble's going to talk quite a bit about this in some registries, how you can look at technique and how important it is as to the survival of these implants. Minimally invasive surgery may certainly be an improvement. Computer-assisted surgery may make this more reliable for patients. And the NIH consensus statement was one of the most important factors leading to successful total knee replacement is proper surgical technique. So function. So if most patients aren't complaining, but is that function they have normal? And can we improve the device? We have an outcome assessment. I mean, how do we tell if a total knee is doing well? And there's we have two scores, the HSS or the Knee Society score. However, these are not self-administered. They focus primarily on pain relief, and they assume that the functional capacity, all you need with your total knee replacement, is to be able to walk, stair climb, get up out of a chair, and that's it. So Jennifer Weiss, one of our orthopedic residents, worked with Dr. Noble and several of us in the lab and published this functional questionnaire in 2002, and went to patients that had unilateral joints with arthritis and a matched age and sex group of patients to look at what's important to this age group. Stretching, turning, cutting, leg strengthening exercises, gardening, sexual activity, kneeling, biking. This is the order of importance of activities people want to do in this age group. Some of these were a surprise in the order in which they came in. Certainly gardening is way up there. And then it may be important to them, but how many are actually participating? And if you look at the normals, people without arthritis, how many are participating in activities? And then our total knee replacement patients that are participating in things such as squatting, kneeling, stretching, moving laterally, turning and cutting. So clearly our patients are participating in this, or at least they're trying to. Well, what's the biggest problem? And it turns out these high demand, high flexion activities are the biggest problem. If you look at the left, it's percentage of moderate or severe difficulty, and you look at the primary total knee replacements, first time total knee replacements, versus people without a knee replacement, you can see in all of these activities, they clearly have much more problems than their age and sex matched compadres. So we have a long way to go in getting knee replacements to function like normals. Well, patient satisfaction, we talked about that, 85% doing well. If we gave that questionnaire to our patients, it was pretty much about the same. We had about 85% say they were doing well, and 11% very dissatisfied or dissatisfied. But why was that? If you looked at the patients who were dissatisfied, is there something that you could come up with? And it's clear it's tied to function. This average composite score is the activity that they want to do, that they're having trouble with, and how important that particular activity is to them. You get a composite score. And so if you look at all these activities, the higher this composite score, the easier it is, the better they're able to do that. So patients that were satisfied with their total knee in blue here could do these things certainly much better than the patients that were dissatisfied. So it's function. It wasn't pain, et cetera. Clearly function plays a big role in the dissatisfaction of patients with their implants. So understanding how knees function and the importance of high flexion became a big part of the lab. And so it's not just Eastern cultures. Here in this country, we've got people that want to kneel and squat, play with grandkids. So this is an area of research that's ongoing. The lab's developed a squatting simulator to understand the biomechanics of high flexion and use it to test and evaluate design features of prototype devices. This squatting simulator also is useful in coming up with a virtual biomechanics system. Taking the physical specimen, taking fluoroscopic images, developing computer reconstructions, and then computer animation of how the joints move, so that you can then perform the procedures in virtual reality or implant the devices and see how they will perform without doing the physical implantations in cadavers over and over. So the cause of the deficit that we're seeing is a functional deficit. The question is it just inherent in total joints, or is there an effect of component design? And we have many different designs, and can we compare these? Is there one that's better than the other? Well, without the functional questionnaire, we hadn't been able to tell. But just comparing one that the posterior stabilized sacrifices the posterior cruciate ligament, and the PCL is a device that preserves the posterior cruciate ligament, and the knee is designed to operate around it. And the one in red, the knee has a design that substitutes for the posterior cruciate ligament. You can see here, in all of our other questionnaires, the Knee Society, the Hip Society, there was no difference in these two groups that were done by a surgeon here at Methodist. But if you looked at where he saved the PCL versus where they substituted for it, in a few high-demand activities, there's a big difference. So this actually caused me to change how I practice. I was using exclusively a posterior stabilized or substituting design, and in higher functioning patients, we've gone to saving the posterior cruciate ligament because it's clear it makes a big difference in their function. So that's led to more research that's ongoing in ways to save not only the posterior cruciate ligament, but every knee replacement we implant now in the U.S., we sacrifice the anterior cruciate ligament. And there's research going on now to save the anterior cruciate ligament as well as the posterior cruciate ligament and design a prosthesis around the ligaments, complement them instead of substituting for them. So to conclude, less invasive, in my mind, isn't just the size of the skin incision. It's skin and muscle sparing. It means you remove less bone. But I think most importantly is that we maintain function. That truly is a less invasive procedure. And it's apparent that if we can start to save ligaments and total knees, that's going to make a big difference. Well, I think the big part of the talk now is going to be on technique, because that's key to us improving the procedure at a level that all surgeons can benefit from. And so I'm going to introduce now Dr. Phil Noble, who's our head of research and has done quite a bit of work with the engineers here in the lab on improving the technique.
Ken and I are a tag team, so I'm going to be talking a bit about new horizons in training surgeons and new techniques that we have, which complements perhaps the efforts of Barbara Bass and what she's doing through the RI. So just to recap a bit, if we go back through registry data, and in Sweden and in some of the Scandinavian countries, they now have several hundred thousand joint replacement patients followed under a socialist system where everybody is registered. If we look at females, elderly females with OA, the hip replacement operation is phenomenal. I mean, regardless of what you do, it seems to do well, with survivorship of up to, you know, right about 95%. 5% reoperations, 10 years. But if you look at younger males, demanding males, unilateral, under 55, the results are not nearly as sanguine, especially after avascular necrosis. So clearly, when we talk about apples and apples, we have to be looking at the risks presented by patients to really get the truth. And what's interesting is when we try and understand what's the role of the surgeon in these successes, one thing that's rather telling is it's true, the implants themselves, these ones here are the ones used today, the four here, the implants themselves have some effect, but not a lot, increasingly less and less. And yet, if you also look at the results of the same implant in different countries, lo and behold, the results are very different. The patients in neighboring countries are not very different. The implants are the same, so I wonder what might be causing the differences. Now, clearly, if we look at all the factors in explaining the longevity of joint replacements, it's phenomenal how many factors there are, and you can imagine there's a whole lot of commercial influence claiming that one design's better than another in the morass of data and the confounding variables. What's not being talked about very much are surgeon factors. The surgeon technique factors seem to be the last thing that anyone's talked about historically as we talk about, you know, comorbidities and risk and implant features and all this stuff. And so it's the surgeon that seems to have escaped. So what we decided to do some time ago as an interesting exercise is to do a numerical simulation on a supercomputer of a clinical trial using a database. And this is rather cool. You can actually do this on a supercomputer where you actually simply posit, you simply invent a database of 1,000 or more patients. And we assign them a hazard function, a risk to every patient based upon published data. And then we take a theoretical group of 50 surgeons and we play around with their results of each surgeon and give them a distribution, a hazard function, and we randomly assign in the computer, well, that was smart, randomly assign 20 patients to each surgeon. We just randomize it. This is called a Monte Carlo simulation. It's used in gambling simulation theory. And just for fun, we then introduce two implants at random in equal numbers, and one implant has twice the success of the other one, proven by RCTs. And we can calculate, using various assumptions, the combined probabilities we compensate for interactions as well. But we can calculate the combined probabilities of these occurrences: surgeon, patient risk, and implant risk. And we're able to roll the dice using the computer over and over again with 1,000 patients and just see how it turns out. Now, of course, if it's fully randomized like an RCT, it turns out that one implant fails 6% of the time and the other implant fails 3% of the time. But it's interesting to see the fluctuation from clinical trial to clinical trial. This is like having a 1,000-patient clinical trial, each roll of the dice. So these aren't little trials. And yet the results can be, you know, up and down by about 1% or 0.75% just because of random variation. But what we did for fun is we said, you know, let's pretend, again, based on published data, let's take the Swedish known hazard function for surgeon performance. This is the surgeon failure rate at 10 years of different surgeons. This is a known fact. And let's, for fun, divide them into three groups: the high-performing surgeons, the less skilled surgeons, and the guys who are just in the middle. And then let's randomize who chooses what patient and who gets to choose what implant and see what happens. So we did an RCT, first of all, as you saw, 3%, 6%. We then said, let the best surgeons get first choice, and they'll choose either the good implant or the less successful implant, and then randomize all the rest of the patients who are left. And if you do that, whichever implant, as you can see, the surgeons choose, bumps up. If the best surgeons choose the best implant, if we have the best surgeon's best implant, it drops it by about 1%. And if they choose the worst implant, they can improve it by about 1%, a bit more than 1%. So they have a slight effect, about 1/3 of an effect on the result. But if you let the less successful surgeons choose the implant, they have a huge effect. In other words, in this case here, you can see that the surgeons here were able to choose the good implant. They made its failure rate go up to 5% from 3%. And in this case here, they were able to make the bad implant go up to 8% from 6%. So it depends enormously on just what 1/5 of the surgeons are doing in terms of which operation and how they do it. And if we combine, as you might expect, the top surgeons and the bottom surgeons all making different choices, you can actually totally reverse the true success and failure rate. You can actually make the poor implant look good and the good implant look poor very effectively. And in fact, if the best surgeons use the best implant and the worst surgeons the worst implant, you get almost no failures in the best implant. So the conclusion that comes out of this is, frankly, as this is based upon real data from Sweden, the results of this kind of surgery is totally dominated at the success rates today of these implants by surgical technique, by the surgeons and how they operate. So because of this, our big thrust has been, how do you impact surgical technique in a free society? Now, in Sweden, it's not quite so free, and so what they've done is a deputation, frankly, of authorities from the society have gone to visit and have a chat with chairmen of departments about how certain people should be re-educated or whatever they should do. And this has increased by about 3 times the success of the procedure. And in fact, this is over a period of 5 years, and the failure rates have dropped from the red curve down to the violet curve in the huge database. So this is extremely potent. We're not a socialist society, but still, obviously, we have the same goal. How can we improve surgical technique? So we have very systematically, in our department, looked at what would the elements be in a training program to train surgeons in a systematic way using, you know, some of the tools that we have, cadavers and simulations in the lab. And the first thing we need, of course, is metrics. Everyone has to agree as to what the technical measurable metrics are for good and bad performance in a surgical procedure. And the way that we do this now is that we have the surgeons, we suggest from societies what those might be, but we have the surgeon agree or disagree to set up their own scorecard in terms of what we should measure and what those outcomes might be. Then we have cadavers to operate on, or we have surrogates for some things, or we can use animals for some things, but cadavers are our mainstay. And we're able then to measure somehow those outcomes. We've had a long program developing technologies to measure stuff, to fill the numbers in the scorecard. And then we've developed realistic surrogates for some key steps of the procedure, so we don't have to be trying to find cadavers all the time. So the aim of a lot of our work in developing what we call a bioskills system has been, as engineers, to look at how the system works conceptually. We have a biological system. We have certain stimuli that we put in a typical procedure. We're focusing as engineers on loads and deformations a lot. We know what the environmental factors are and the biochemical influences, but we can also then measure what happens. How much does the tissue move? How much is it strained? Does it become apoxic? Does it become macerated? What are the limits taking place here? We're able to measure all of these things and all of these things and therefore use them to fill in our scorecard. So the various modalities, the tools we have now in the lab that we developed are actually very sophisticated. We have cadavers, we reconstruct them using CT or MR, and then we attach to those cadavers or follow those cadavers with the following sorts of instrumentation. We've got techniques for displacement and motion of soft and hard tissues we'll come to, and we're able to measure forces and accelerations of the tissue and the bones and the strain in the bones and the tissue, and from that deduce what's taking place, what's good, what's bad, what's an improvement. Now, a lot of this, I thought I'd have a little pause, a lot of this is based on concepts that may be a little bit strange, and it's the interface that we call computer vision. It's the interface between physical and virtual space, which is a big part of what we do. In other words, if we have a real cadaver or a real patient, we're going to do imaging, and imaging basically is creating a computer or virtual model of a real physical object, a patient. And in that computer electron model on the screen, we do various manipulations and measurements, which we can then relate back to the physical person. So in the physical space, the space in the lab with a real cadaver that has a real weight and a real resistance to being prodded, we can talk about its fixed dimensions and its properties and its boundaries, and we can't see through it, and we can describe it in a physical way. If we image that cadaver and we have a ghostly representation on the computer screen, we can measure it, but it's light. We can put things through it. We can insert things into it. There are no boundaries. There are dimensions. It's permeable and transparent. We can see through it to see the joints and how they're moving by changing the transparent quality of those tissues in virtual space. Now, you may say, well, what kind of imaging do we use? Imaging is the acquisition of virtual images, really, of data. And, of course, we can go to the most sophisticated tools, as you see. And this includes laser scanning, which we'll come to next. But we can do the traditional reconstruction, as you can see, of MR scans or CT scans to acquire data. Now, a big mainstay of our work is something called computer vision. And those of you who remember Terminator remember this concept of the robot being able to look at a person or an object and not just recognize them in the sense of, you know, I can tell that two-dimensional image of your face so I know who you are, but rather acquiring the 3D full object, the boundary of the person with all that data that's attached. And so you know actually the size and the shape of the individual as well as how they look projected. This is extremely valuable. And so in the lab, we're developing tools involving computer vision, where we actually, kind of like the Terminator, we don't have Arnold in the lab, but like the Terminator, we can look at a cadaver and identify and follow what's going on. This is what we're doing with Gene Orford. And this isn't Gene, but we're able to take a physical image, like a person sitting here in the audience. And this is just a 2D projection of how they look on a plane. But using computer vision, we're able to acquire, this is a computer reconstruction, believe it or not. And it's not just this flat plane. In fact, I could turn on the computer and we could rotate it around. It's a three-dimensional head, as if it was the person's head sitting right there. So we can measure it and we can do things with it and we can see how it deforms. So we're able, how do we see how it deforms? We're able to zoom in to the surface, just like the Terminator, and we're able to impose a grid on the surface, a grid of points. And these are all, this is the mesh. Now, this is just data. Here are the coordinates of every little point. There are hundreds of thousands of points. It's just data. That's all it is, projected on a screen. Because it's just data, we can do many things with it. As you can see, we can rotate it around. We can look at it. We can measure it. We can measure changes in it. We can measure stretches in it. So it has great application for everything surgical involving soft tissues, whether it be in plastic surgery or MIS surgery in orthopedics. Now, Ken mentioned to us that in MIS surgery, in cadavers at least, we're able to go in and actually put fiduciary points, just like that mesh you saw, on the skin. And using computer vision, we can actually not follow the skin. We're just following the ink blots. The skin happens to be pulling the ink blots, but we're just following those ink spots. And we can do it in ultraviolet light, as you can see, or we can do it in real light. And we're able, with computer vision, to look frame by frame that we acquire and identify where the points are. This is from Matt Thompson's work, and this is at a critical stage during the procedure. And we can zoom in, find all the points, and then it becomes a mesh just like before, just like that face. And we can do calculations mathematically on the mesh, and we can show how much the surgeon is stretching the tissue. It's a procedure that Ken was doing through one of his small incisions, and we're able from that then to calculate from Matt's work how much strain we have deforming the tissues. Now, on the computer, we can remove the retractors and show how much is taking place behind the retractors stretching the tissue. And so we can make changes in either the procedure, the incision, or the retractors in order to get these optimized. It all depends on having a measurement technique in the get-go. The other thing we can do, once again, using that transparent quality of computer vision, of virtual space, is we can actually go back now to a physical video, and frame by frame we can superimpose the skeleton predicted onto the physical body. So here we have a melding of physical space and virtual space. This obviously doesn't exist except on the computer screen. The person in the therapy, you know, hasn't got this skeleton hanging off them. This is just a melding of images that are registered accurately to each other. And this is obviously a beautiful tool for looking at the performance of the implant during the real procedure itself on a patient-by-patient basis. So this brings me to computerized bioskills. With all of these tools we've developed, we can now get surgeons set to working on a cadaver. And you can imagine we can apply those tools, watching exactly what the surgeon does, and as a teaching tool to check and to measure the surgeon's performance, the trainee's performance, with respect to what we were hoping to achieve. And the way we do this is, again, by starting off with a melding of physical space and virtual space. So we start off on the computer screen where we have a computer reconstruction, a virtual model of the bones of a patient or a cadaver, and a virtual model, computer model, of the instruments and the implants. And the surgeon does the surgery on the computer and ends up with a certain placement, or every step is done virtually. And the computer is keeping track of how the surgeon was proposing to align everything, make the cuts, and is keeping track of that's the perfect way of doing it, let's say. And then the surgeon goes into physical space next door in the real world and works on a real cadaver And we have computer vision watching what the surgeon's doing. And then, of course, Judgment Day, the two are brought together on a computer, rather like that picture of the person kneeling, and we overlap them and meld them together, and we're able to measure the differences in critical parameters between the two, and as a result, we give coordinates in red and green showing what the deviations are from what the intended result was at every step. And then we can work on trying to get it closer if there's some deviation that we would like to train out or remove. And the key to this, of course, is in every procedure, once again, having the agreement, as in knee replacement, for example, the agreement of the surgeon as to what the metrics would be for defining, at least, what a good result would be. And then we have to agree on what the numbers would be for each of these in terms of a good, better, and best technique. This is part of the benchmarking best practices procedure. So we're able, for example, this is a typical output. This is the actual reconstructed bones of a cadaver. The surgeon's operated, has finished doing a joint replacement. That's an artificial knee. And we've got all of this scorecard of various shifts in the bones, various changes in alignment compared to what the surgeon was hoping to do. Now, the really cool thing is, again, virtual objects are transparent. So we're able to remove the tissue and actually do a play-by-play of what happened at key steps in the operation without hands, without muscle, without anything except the bones and the instruments. And then we're able to focus in on exactly what went on and why. So if there's a miscut, as there is here, the surface here was supposed to be flat, matching the green, and it was off by quite a lot, we can go back and find what mistake was made to deflect that cutting surface. And typically there are a few steps that may not have been quite right that caused that. And using this tool, it's wonderful because we can put through a whole group of surgeons, trainees, fellows, residents, doing the same procedure with the same instruments, and we can get metrics then on what would be the normal range of customary procedure, what's the normal standard of practice, if you will, great for legal defense, great for training. So we're able to identify from a group of surgeons, for example, as to where they end up in terms of both a bony measurement of the alignment of the leg and also a soft tissue leg measurement of how far off we are when we stretch the joint out in extension. Two soft and hard tissue indicators. We can also put through people at different levels of training. We can establish norms, in fact, for faculty members, for experienced surgeons, which you see here in yellow, and then we can look at trainees, fellows, residents, rather than just using an apprentice-based way of training. You know, watch me and try it out on somebody. We can actually have people rehearse procedures in the lab with cadavers, and then when they have reached a particular level here, we're able to perhaps certify that they can then move to the next step, is one approach. We're able to also go through and actually quantify very carefully what the areas of weakness and what the strengths are of each person operating based upon the background of many experienced surgeons who've done it before. And we're able to go through and actually identify which particular instrument or step is typically the troublesome one. So our training can focus in much more detail, on this step rather than this step, which clearly isn't a problem. No point, you know, beating to death things that aren't a problem. You can focus a lot of your energy on, do we have to have a little module for training, which we can with surrogates? What's the difficulty here compared to the others? Perhaps we need to refine our instruments. Perhaps we need to refine our training or both. And we're able to give surgeons, as you can see here, very crystal clear, simplistic pictures of, you know, what you have to do. In other words, step by step, it may sound silly, but, you know, rather than putting the rod here, put it here. You know, it's like dance steps. Put it here. If you put it here, you won't have the trouble. And if you make it simple like this, And we found that trainees, at least, are able to pick up on this perhaps much faster than you were supposed to have noticed the professor doing that, but no one ever told you kind of learning that may take place in other places. So why do this? Well, the reason for doing it, rather than some other approaches perhaps that involve navigation and other computerized tools, we're bullish on this because every surgeon can do this regardless of where they come from. They can travel here or to a training center and everyone has equal access. You know, it was once said that if the surgeons who write articles for our journals and who get the wonderful results apparently that don't reflect the Medicare database, but if those surgeons were to treat, you know, 24 hours a day, all the patients they could, they'd have about a 3% impact on the burden that we have of treating arthritis. So the answer isn't just thumping your chest and being in your ivory tower. It's actually training the rest of the people who are not going to be in those circles, who are in different environments. And we think this is a great way of doing it. It preserves surgeon control. The surgeon is the one who's operating, but with improved training. It's very much like flight training for the airlines, and it doesn't expose patients to additional risk, which we think is long overdue. Now, there are many other things that can be done with this system that we don't have time to talk about today, but with the tools that we now have in the lab, we're able to project forward as to how a joint will function before we sign off on the joint. We're able to predict the range of motion for every case, if we wish, you know, before we close or in general terms. We're able to show where there may be errors in technique that need to be corrected, and we're able to measure soft tissue tension as well, which is going to be is an interesting issue in some of the applications that we confront. This particular system we are planning on developing further. Obviously, this is not a small undertaking in many ways, both in terms of the volume and cost of the work. But we think it's very valuable for certification, for training, for legal defense, and for evaluations of instruments and surgical strategies. And it also has real application today in making operating rooms much more efficient, which we think surely must be where the future is in this cost environment. So all who wander are not lost, and that's our credo. We're very privileged to be able in the hospital with the support of the Dunn Foundation to explore many of these crazy things that I think will have fruition in the end for all of us. Thank you very much.